Mini episode 871 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 871. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris here, along with another one of our longtime dignitaries, the proprietor of Sportsology, Russ Cohen, and also a multi-time published author. And as was the case past times when he was doing a book tour, he has stopped back in here in the lounge to talk about his new one, Pioneers of Baseball. And it discusses, of course, old-timey baseball from about 1890 to 1910. And there are also some notes in there that go before that period of time and after that period of time, but it seems to go predominantly along the lines of those 20 years. So welcome back in to talk about another book, Russ. And first of all, please talk about your thought process as far as how you ended up on this specific time period in baseball.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really drawing from, like, my childhood here, even though I am old. it's one of those things where I got an email that, hey, check this out. The New York Public Library have a bunch of digital images, and they're all public domain. You know, and I'm like, that's interesting. I'll take a look at it. And, you know, I looked at the hockey ones, and it was sparse. And I'm like, well, there's no good great hockey images. There was one nice one. But I noticed there were a lot of baseball. And I stumbled upon, after a couple of pictures, a collection of pictures from Albert Spalding, who, you know, he's from this famous Spalding Sporting Goods Company, and he also played. And apparently he had a collection, and that was digitized by the New York Public Library and for fair use. And, of course, you still have to sort of do some digging and make sure, you know, rights weren't bought up and stuff. And, you know, we went and did due diligence. And so the main part of it, most of it, is based on that. There's some photos in there that are not from the collection, but there were just a couple of good team stories that were so good that we just, well, not we, it's me this time, just felt like I had to talk about it. So I did branch off a little bit, but not too much.
Well, it was very interesting the way that you took those images, and the book basically surrounds those images with text, background on the players and the events of the time. And something that I thought was very interesting, because you write about something in there that when we look at the major sporting events in American history, we're not used to thinking about them this far back. You may have identified the first major mega sporting event in American history, 1866, a championship ball game between the Brooklyn and Philadelphia clubs that, as you said, it was covered by Harper's Weekly, got a lot of major media attention at the time. Harper's Weekly, that being the equivalent of probably several major networks in 1866 America. So talk about that event, how you learned about it, and what your thought process was as you were going through the process of learning about it.
Yeah, you know, what happens is I started going back, and I was like, I wonder, you know, how far back I could really go here before, maybe it's just not a good thing at all because it really isn't baseball. And I just got from piecing stuff together, you know, you're able to find stuff on Harper's Weekly, oddly enough, and that was surprising. And so, yeah, pictures are obviously hard to find, and box scores and things like that, but I was just able to, you know, just sort of casually mention it and thought to myself, yeah, this is definitely something of note, and you know, I think the reader would like it.
Yeah, it was very enlightening to read about that, and I know that in terms of digging up tidbits, there's something that I know you're going to want to expound upon here. I believe it's on page 47 about the story of Mike Lehane and what you found in the course of your research.
Yeah, so there was a guy, Michael Lehane, and he, for some reason, I was having trouble finding players from this Columbus Salons, and so he was the one lone pitcher, and so I said, all right, let me dig up what I can about Mike Lehane, you know, and it's not easy. And I remember that leaving two or three newspaper articles on him that basically Mike Lehane died and nobody knew why. And even like in places like Baseball Reference, which I'm going to be telling them that we figured out how, you know, didn't have a cause of death. I wasn't able to find the cause of death. And I looked in all of the newspapers I looked at and I found, you know, obituaries, and I got nothing. And I couldn't find him in the obituaries, even though I kind of had an idea of the date that he died and the year. So a friend of mine, Rhonda McClure, she's a hockey writer, but she's also, by day, works with the New England Historic Genealogical Society. And I said, hey, if you find out anything about how this guy died, I'd really be appreciative. And I say it took maybe about a week, maybe 2 weeks, because, you know, she had a job. She wasn't like she was looking just for me. And she found out that he died of an autoimmune disease. And it was chronic kidney nephritis. And so, you know, that's an interesting thing, because autoimmune diseases now, pretty common. Autoimmune diseases then, not so common. So that's something where, you know, you don't really, I don't recall ever coming across another player where I saw that. So I found it interesting, and then I started looking up autoimmune diseases, as we know now, like lupus and things like that, and just trying to see what might fit for them. But, you know, they had it pretty much pegged back then, but they probably couldn't have told him what caused it or anything like that back then. You know, they just didn't have enough information. And so I found that kind of interesting, and I felt good about it, where, like, I was able to at least close the chapter on this guy. He was a New York City guy, and after playing baseball, he still worked in New York City as a pipe fitter. Because, you know, he wasn't making enough money as a ball player.
Right.
But he was a pretty good ball player. You know, he played 140 games one year at 56 RBIs, and so I just became invested in it. In a weird sort of way.
Well, I can't further solve what happened with him, but I can recklessly speculate, and I'll tell you this much, because from about 2 years ago, being diagnosed with celiac disease and learning that it's always been around, but it's only ever recently been pegged as being something, people used to just die mysteriously of autoimmune diseases, and people didn't know what the root cause of it was. So I'm not going to say he had celiac disease, but I'm going to tell you it's entirely possible that he did, and that perhaps a gluten-free diet, hard though that would have been to do in late 19th century America, could possibly have held that off. Who knows, Russ?
It would have been interesting had he walked into the general store and said, yeah, what do you have without gluten? They might have just looked at him like, what's gluten?
Yeah, it's... If I ever do any time travel going backwards, if they get that invented, I'm going to have some real issues with that. It won't be the predominant reason that people look at me strange. It'll probably be other things that I say, but it'll be a contributory reason to that anyways. But
yeah, no doubt.
As far as other colorful tidbits here in the history of baseball as chronicled in this book, certainly, there are a couple teams that you in particular had your eye on, be they the Hartford Dark Blues or the Buffalo Bisons.
Yeah.
They had a lot of very colorful tidbits in here.
Yeah, the Hartford Dark Blues is an interesting one. It's one of those things where I said, you know, I looked around and I wanted to find teams from different cities that maybe haven't had baseball in a very long time. And so Hartford was one of those that came to mind. And, you know, we always think of Hartford like, hey, this is this big insurance city. But, you know, back in the day, it was a pretty good sports city, too. And so when you look up the Hartford Dark Blues, there was one guy who kept coming up. And it wasn't Bob Ferguson, who was a really good player. It was their biggest fan. And so their biggest fan had a picture in the New York Public Library collection, but not in the baseball part of it. So I had to sort of go and pull that, and it was Samuel Clemens. Mark Twain, huge baseball guy. He used to just go there and just sit in the stands and watch games. I mean, he did write about it in Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. He was one of the most famous people in the world at the time. You know, so like the Boston Globe would print his baseball musings, and you know, so pretty interesting dude. And
yes.
And he wanted to also be an umpire, and he never got to really fulfill that. But he was close to doing it once in an exhibition game, and then something happened in the last minute and he backed out. So Mark Twain, yeah, I thought that was, you know, anytime you can get a guy like that, to me that's interesting. But also in Hartford, they may have the first old timers game.
Okay.
Had a basically a benefit game, so that's kind of cool too.
That is.
You know, there was a young teammate who drowned while fishing, and they wanted to raise money. So, you know, the funny thing is that, you know, we're good baseball guys, and we think we know everything about the game. But then you realize, you don't know anything about the game pre-Babe Ruth, really. I mean, you know, there's stuff, go to the Hall of Fame, you learn some stuff. And I remember even when I was younger, I used to sort of, not discount this era, but just not pay enough attention to it. Like, yeah, it's old. I'd look up the rule changes. Look, if the ball hits over, you know, one hop over the wall, or, you know, all the quirkiness of it. But then over time, I realized, you know, a lot of players from this era sort of get gypped. You know, they were pioneers of the game. It wasn't their fault the way they played. It wasn't their fault that, you know, they didn't have gloves for a while, and then they didn't have the right size gloves for a while, and then the ball was dead, and they did the best they could, but there were some amazing athletes. You know, when you look at guys, you could find bizarre pitching records, you know, guys winning, you know, well over 30 games, guys winning 40 games. But you could say, hey, you know, the players weren't that good and the fields weren't this. But, you know, 60 feet, 6 inches was always the measurement, and you still had to go through the motions of throwing the ball.
That's true.
So whether, you know, the top pitcher, the velocity back then might have been 75 miles per hour, you still had to do it. And you still had to throw it for all those innings. And so you still have to give the guys credit for that.
Yeah, you certainly do. No question about it. And again, it is a period of time where it's a little bit more obscure as far as the contributions to the overall history of baseball. You're right about that. And this book is one that it spotlights a lot of things that are very much under the radar, as well as telling us a little bit more about some of the names that we do know from that period of time. Me being a lifelong denizen of America's North Coast, I asked you early on if there was going to be anything on there on Napoleon Lajoie, and you replied that there would be, and there is a blurb on him here, albeit with his pre-Indians career. But yep. Names like him, Connie Mack, it's a chance for you to expound on some of the names that, if you are a real baseball fan, you already know something about them, and it's a chance to tell more of the story.
I mentioned that a couple times. He's in there with the Bisons, which I didn't know about Connie Mack and the Bisons.
Mm-hmm.
I'll admit it. You know, he played 4 years with the Washington Nationals before even joining the Bisons. You know, I didn't know about that. I only knew about Connie Mack, the manager and the owner, the guy
right.
who wore the suit. I didn't know that he was a catcher. You know, I didn't know that he put his life savings into the team.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there were, you know, there's some things that you learn, and you're like, wow. And so he's actually in there in two sections. He's in there for the Athletics, too. So he's one of those guys that sort of is so important in this era that, you know, he had an impact really on two franchises like that. The Bisons is a cool thing. One of the people who I get a quote from for the cover is Pete Weber. He used to be one of the voices of the Buffalo Bisons before he was with hockey and most famously with the Nashville Predators, who mm-hmm. just had a nice little Stanley Cup run. So, yeah, Pete Weber is a huge baseball guy.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, I got to look it up how many years. Let's see. He was with the Bisons. But he has been with me every step of the way of this book. He was so invested in it. And he's such a nice guy. He's just such a down-to-earth guy, but he knows everybody. He's a really good friend of Terry Collins. He seems to know everybody from baseball and from hockey. And so it was kind of nice to have him in my corner, you know, like, hey, you know, Pete, here, you could check out the progress, and I would check out, and he would check out the progress and send something encouraging back. And it was always good stuff, you know. It was always like, hey, yeah, keep up the good work. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that guy. And I'm thinking, well, he knows more about baseball than I do. And I thought I really knew a lot.
Well, I will say, on the subject of the Buffalo Bisons, who have survived through the decades as a member of the International League at the
Triple. By the way, 13 years. I just have a cheat on Google. 13 years he was the play-by-play for the Bisons.
Okay. I don't know if this overlapped with a period of time or not, but I will say, of the couple of different shows that in some small way were sort of precursor shows to the FDH Lounge back at the old Sports Talk Network, one of them was myself. I was sidekicking for a present FDH Lounge dignitary, my good friend Ken Detweiler, on the show Life's a Pitch with Ken Detweiler. And at the time, the Bisons were a AAA affiliate of the Indians. And we were doing a thing at the time where we were talking to people from different affiliates and having them on the show. And they, out of a nice reciprocal sense of appreciation, were kind enough to have Ken and I come up for a day and throw out the first pitch at a game. And great memories of that. Went up there with my dad, had a heck of a time. I got a tour around the ballpark. That is a class organization up there in Buffalo, to be sure. I have one kind of sour memory of the day, which is the PR guy couldn't have been nicer and more welcoming and accommodating and lining up interviews for me and stuff, but Brandon Phillips, quite frankly, was a real dick to me that day because he didn't want to be there, and he had a bad attitude about it and whatever, and I'm just trying to ask questions politely, and I hadn't even asked to talk to him specifically, by the way. I was just talking to whoever the PR guy was bringing me over,
right.
And the PR guy thought he was helping me by bringing me Brandon Phillips, and not so much, as it turned out. But the Bisons themselves, yeah, a great class organization, and it's just interesting to see what their roots were, and at an actual major league level, if you go that much further back. Buffalo has always been a terrific baseball city.
Yeah, and where they played doesn't exist anymore, but, you know, you could find a lot of these spots where they are in the cities. And so if you look it up, you could see where these places were.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of interesting, too. I do. I had a good time sort of seeing where some of these, because you wonder, like, what happened, you know, what exactly happened here? You had a baseball stadium, it got torn down or burnt down. I mean, a lot of them did, believe it or not, just, you know, they were built with wood.
Yep.
And fire would just take them out. And we're not accustomed to sort of seeing that in nowadays, but in those days, it was pretty regular occurrence. Like, a good example is one of the teams of pictures that is not from the collection is the baseball in Louisville.
Uh-huh.
I think Louisville is a cool place, and I looked at that stadium and I said, wow, that is a cool picture. It is like, it looks more like a racetrack than it does a baseball stadium. It even looks older than we saw the Columbus Clippers all those years ago.
That's right.
And that had that look to it. And so I asked the University of Louisville, who owned the picture, is it okay to use it? And they said, yeah. And you look at it and you say, yeah, the Louisville Colonels. Like, that's a great name, right? Whoever thought of that name, that was good. But they also had the Louisville Eclipse.
Right.
Which was the other name. So you go back to the 1880s with that. And, yeah, they had some great players. Honus Wagner made his debut in the Eclipse Stadium. That's amazing. I mean, Honus Wagner is still one of the great players of all time. And so, you know, I figured I have to put this in there. Like, so once in a while I would get away from it. You know, like they once played the Brooklyn Bridegrooms. I think that's one of the all-time great names.
They used to have such outstanding names back then for some of the teams. And I cheated right now before bringing this up by looking on Google, but I will say it did confirm what I thought I knew, which is I looked on Google when you mentioned about wooden stadiums because I started thinking about the risk of fire. And, of course, the old Baker Bowl right in your backyard there. That was something that, as my Google search confirmed, suffered huge fire damage in the grandstands back in the day. So that was the kind of thing you would be susceptible to, and that was cutting-edge technology.
It was cutting-edge, but it was definitely something that could really just ruin your franchise. I mean, you know, I don't think guys had fire insurance, so they'd have to just start over.
Right.
It was hard. I mean, I'm going to look up, I think, and again, I don't have all this committed to memory, you know. It's like I'm still retaining a lot of this because it was a lot to take in. You know, I met a nice guy, friend of a friend recently, and his daughter was talking to me about the book, and she goes, oh, so you have pictures and you just caption them. And I'm like, yeah, I did do that.
You were like, little more than that, sweetie.
but I'm like, but it's harder than you think. I'm like, you know, you still have to piece together all the information that's out there. I'm like, it's a little more than that, but I get it. Like, I did laugh. But the Detroit Wolverines, I believe, also had a stadium issue. And so that was a thing where, you know, again, even in a big city like Detroit, it affected them.
I have a fascination myself with old ballparks. I have a picture hanging up in my home office of Ebbets Field from back in the day, and I've been always fascinated by the history of League Park here in Cleveland, and I've always thought to myself that if I get off my duff one of these winters here when there's no baseball, I've been saying this for a long time, I'd like to put together a league in one of these what-if sports type things here, and that I would have to make sure the league field or League Park was my home field if I did that, but you know, they've just done a big restoration thing on it there. Obviously, it'll never look like it used to back in the day, but it's more of a semblance of what it used to be than it was for many decades. And then down in Cincinnati, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this or not, but they have a partial recreation of Crosley Field at the it's the municipal recreational area in a suburb called Blue Ash. And I've been there to see it.
I didn't know that.
It's really interesting. I recommend it to anybody who's ever in the greater Cincinnati area. If you're a fan of this kind of stuff, Blue Ash is a northernmost suburb. It is just inside the beltway that goes all around greater Cincinnati. And at their municipal recreational area, they have a partial recreation. They transplanted part of the grandstands out there, and the scoreboard, the way that it was the final night in, I think, August 1970, and it's got the scores on the scoreboard as they were throughout Major League Baseball that night. I think they may even have a hill in the outfield there because, again, that's the predecessor of what they did in Houston with Tal's Hill when Minute Maid Park went in all those years ago. Of course, they took that thing from Cincinnati directly. So for people that are big fans of this kind of stuff, you have some scraps here and there in different cities, and the Cincinnati one is most unusual of all because it's the partial recreation of it is way off-site from where it used to be in downtown Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's cool. I like stuff like that. I like looking up where it is now. Like, you know, when I was a kid, my dad brought me to the Ebbets Field apartments. And so he said, yeah, we used to go see the baseball game here. So, yeah, I think all that stuff is just fantastic. It's fun. It probably wasn't fun at the time, like when stadiums were burning down.
Right.
But but it's one of those things where, you know, it's all part of history, and yeah, it looks like a place called Mack Park that was in Detroit burned down.
Okay.
So in 1929, if that's right, not in the book here, but I remember they had a problem because I remember it in when I was looking up other ballparks when you're trying to get information and piece it together, I came across that.
Well,
so, yeah, I mean,
yeah,
it's something that happened a lot. Yeah, it burned down in 1929.
And while that may not be in the book here, there's definitely some stuff in the book with vintage ballparks as well, both obviously from the photography as well as you talk about the old New York Metropolitans, the original ones from back then, as it were. the St. George Cricket Grounds playing there. So wrap your mind around that, people. At one time in this country, cricket was sufficiently large enough to where baseball teams would play their games in the park, not least of which, like when MLB goes to Australia and is forced to play in cricket grounds there. So, too, it was in late 19th century America.
It was a dual-purpose stadium.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's because, again, obviously, in late 19th century America, you weren't going to be really finding any parks out there that were going to be just perfectly configured for baseball. So it was sort of a catch-as-catch-can deal as far as setting up shop and whatever facilities were in a given area in a major league city. And, again, that part of it here, this aspect that we're talking about with the ballparks, this is definitely another one of these very strong subsections to the book here. You definitely learn some things and get to see some cool pictures of old parks.
You know, a couple things. Like, I tried to get into the rules a little bit and the rule changes, and, well, you have to look at stuff 15 times to sort of get that right. So that was fun to do. I just felt like showing off some of the quirky rules would be good, but also the food industry. Like, it's amazing how the food industry has changed. And so I looked at it, and I was curious, like, gee, I wonder when the first hamburger was sold, you know? And it was in, like, 1880.
Wow.
And I was like, well, that seems, to me, that seemed pretty recent to the kind of book I was doing.
Yeah.
So then I said, well, what about hot dogs? Like, hot dogs has always been attached to baseball. And so, you know, hot dogs actually came into the ballpark in 1901.
Okay.
So it was interesting, even though it was invented in 1867, it took longer than hamburgers. I don't know why. Just may have been just supply and demand. But, you know, so these are things, you know, the Polo Grounds was the first one to sell a hot dog in New York.
Okay.
And it was more of a sausage, really.
Yeah.
So, you know, you find those things and you say, all right, that's kind of cool. And Cracker Jacks, you know, you kind of wonder, hey, is that urban legend? When did it actually start? Was it always there? You know, 1896 for Cracker Jack, you know.
Well, yeah. Food's always been a big part of the experience.
A lot of choices, though.
Right.
Like, literally, if you went to a game, you could get, you know, a hot dog and a drink, or a hamburger and a drink, maybe some peanuts, maybe some Cracker Jacks. And that's about it. You were watching the game. Now, we're eating all kinds of stuff, waiting online for it.
Well, in a little bit of the more things change, the more they stay the same. A gluten-free guy like me is SOL today, as I know I would have been way back then. So some things are as they were back in the day, Russ. We don't always get these changes for the better. But, you know, certainly, the book does a great job of really kind of summing up, as you said in terms of your premise for this, a little-known, little-understood chapter in the history of Major League Baseball. Because certainly, again, what people tend to think of as far as that rough kind of line of demarcation of baseball, even old-time baseball as we know it, basically once in the span of a couple of years, they got rid of the spitter, Babe Ruth came into prominence, post-1918 Black Sox scandal, all these things together in the 1910s tend to be kind of more or less when we tend to think of baseball as it came to be. And then by the time you get into the 1930s, you've got an offensive explosion that kind of rivals what we've seen in the 90s, or if you're looking at a home run only basis, what you've seen 2015 to 2017. So there are certain ebbs and flows that reoccur throughout baseball history, but the one that's never reoccurred has been the dead ball era. And that is something that, again, that is why it has been kind of banished to sort of the back room of history here. And again, the book, I think, does a tremendous job of making this period of time accessible and understandable to people in a very entertaining way.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, there's some fun things, too. Like, you look up guys, like, there was the Philadelphia Quakers, and they were a pretty good team. There was a guy named George Wood. His nickname was Dandy. You know, everybody's got a nickname of Dandy. That's pretty good, right? Don Meredith is the one who everybody comes to mind with Dandy, but clearly this predates him. And the interesting thing about this guy is he's believed to be the first major leaguer from Prince Edward Island, from the Canadian province of Prince Edward Island.
Now, okay.
he was a really good player. He hit 14 homers 1 year, which is a dead ball here. He's a lot of homers.
Right.
But he was inducted into Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame in 2011. Like, it took him a long time.
Yeah.
He played in 1886, so, like, literally he was forgotten about.
Yeah. Well, some people just kind of fall through the cracks of history. They do. I've got a friend who's been working on and off on a screenplay the last couple of years with the idea for one about a major American history from the time of, like, the Barbary Wars. So you get that sometimes, whether it be somebody from the Barbary Wars, whether it be a Canadian baseball player that hit 14 home runs in a time where that was a lot. Sometimes you get that. Sometimes you get things that fall through the cracks of history, and you've certainly done that here with numerous examples in this book.
Like, here's one more good guy, like, Dummy Hoy. He also played for the Bisons. He, in this book, I chronicled the Bisons, but he later played with the Reds for a long time, 14 years. And his nickname was Dummy because he was deaf.
Okay.
And he played high school baseball at the Ohio School for the Deaf. And he broke in at the age of 26. Now, just imagine breaking into baseball, you can't hear, and it's 1890.
Ooh.
And guys, you know, guys that are nicknamed you Dummy.
Yeah.
Like, already, it's not starting off great. And I thought it's sort of amazing that just the Cincinnati Reds only put him in the Hall of Fame, their Hall of Fame, in 2003.
Yeah. I don't know what explains that.
And it's like, well, he was, you know, he's in the record books for them. He was quite a base stealer and other things. I think he's Hall of Fame worthy because, again, we probably think of Curtis Pride when we think of, you know, deaf players. I remember that was in my era, and he played. But back then, it was, you know, it was hard. And, you know, there's also a thought. I kept it out of the book because it was a little controversial, and it was not really known. But it seems like the basically the hand signals that we see in the game now may be because of when he was playing.
Wow. That would be interesting if it traced right back to him then. But it makes sense.
But it's on and off. Like,
yeah.
In some areas, you see that it does, and in others, it doesn't. So I left it out because I didn't want people to say, well, it's not confirmed. You know, it's like, I get
right.
It. But it is one of those things where it would make sense. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I just think it's cool. I think it's cool that places had more than one team, you know, areas. You know, you had Pittsburgh had a couple teams over time, and it's just weird. Things were weird. It's just like, I don't know, it's not like today where, you know, they have all these viability reports and they'll look at how many people live there and, you know, they can get a pretty good cross-section. But back in the day, they just put teams up, man. Like, they didn't, I don't think they did any studies. I don't think there was any hard data. I think if they just, you know, if there was a guy with money and he decided, you know, hey, let's put up a team, then yeah, why not?
I'm always fascinated by different measures of the breadth of my friends, how much they stretch from one area to another area. For like for example, like in you're somebody who fits the bill in a couple of different cases. You're somebody that fits the bill in terms of, I know to you, even the term clean coal is a curse word or two curse words, versus I have another friend who's very pro coal because his dad worked in a mine. So it's like,
right.
My friends in many different ways. And here's another one. Here you are, my friend, writing this book about old-timey baseball. Another good friend of mine, a radio producer and host by the name of Tony Mazur, also does a little bit of work for MLB, working for StatCast. So I have a guy like you writing an old-timey baseball book, and here he is on the cutting edge with all these things and launch entry and this and that and whatever. So it is fascinating to have two friends at such extremes on the parts of baseball history like that.
Like, even think about this. Like, Wilmington, Delaware have a team.
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Oh.
Delaware's so small. Like, why?
Oh, yeah. And, well, look, and I've done some things in terms of looking up stuff with football, and I've long been fascinated by this, living just down the road from the Pro Football Hall of Fame here, which is going to be celebrating the centennial of the league in 2020. I think there's a very good chance that the draft is going to be in Canton that year at their brand new expanded campus down there, and I'm really looking forward to it. But yeah, and looking at the history of that league, the Canton Bulldogs. Portsmouth, Ohio had a freaking team. I think it was the predecessor of the Detroit Lions. So these towns all around us here, and again, I happen to live in an area that had a bunch of them for the NFL. If you're looking at my state and surrounding areas, I know exactly what you're talking about, because teams today that couldn't even probably get a team in a high single A baseball league were playing at the highest level of the NFL and of baseball way back then.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, some other interesting things. Like, there were a few years where there was no segregation in the game, and then there was segregation in the game. And so, you know, I did cover that, you know, best I could. I wasn't, when you're doing a book like this, you're not passing judgment, right? You're just sort of writing about the history of it. And so, like, there was a team, the Royal Giants of Brooklyn, and I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. Or, you know, and they were a Negro League team, and they were amazing. I mean, they were a great team, and so I felt like, you know, they should be in there. And so, you know, there's a little bit of that, too. And there was also the Royal Giants of Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a black owner, you know, and they used to do barnstorming and play against Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and guys like that. So that team lasted a long time. And so I felt like, you know, those guys definitely needed to be in the game, too. And, you know, and I get all the nuances of what happened and how it happened and what was right and wrong about it. But I just basically covered it. That's all I was doing, you know? So I tried to just include what I could.
Well, I applaud that as an approach because, not to go too far down that particular rat hole, but if you just look at some debates in society over the course of the last couple of weeks here, we have a tendency to be very, very self-righteous about the mores of earlier periods here. I mean, there are things where, again, you know, certainly I shake my head and I look at that and everything, but there comes a point in time at the end of the day where, you know, obviously you acknowledge that, you know, we have evolved in a lot of ways like that. You wouldn't have segregation in the game today or in society or whatever, but there are certain things that do have to be judged through the prism of the time, so I'm always appreciative when somebody does that. I mean, it doesn't mean you're saying it's okay. You're only saying it's okay if you're saying it's okay, but to judge everything by the prism of the time is very much key.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's basically what I do, and, you know, people will see some guys, if I had more information, I put more. Like, the great thing about motivational press is they didn't put restrictions on how long each caption could be, because that's another thing where I've done another photo book, and companies want to have a definite amount. You could have this many, but don't go over this many. And they were just like, hey, if you've got more on some, then just include it. And so, you know, some of them will have a much larger one. So, you know, I think that's good, too, because if I could find something and get it confirmed, then I included it. You know, like, there was a player from, a guy named Tommy Bonds, and he's from, he was the first major league player born in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Played in major leagues. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
That is.
Back in 1874.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of many, many great different tidbits that are dug up here in this book, Pioneers of Baseball. And so tell the people, Russ, in terms of the availability of the book, how they can get their hands on it.
Right now, you can go to Amazon.com or you can go to MotivationalPress.com and pre-order. I got a little tingly when it said hardcover. Because, you know, I find these things out after the fact.
Like, okay.
And motivational is great. Like, they really give you a lot of freedom as the author, and very little direction but a lot of help. And so that's great. And what I like about them is I'm really, not only am I a part of the process, but I'm really approving and disproving things. And so, like, when I want to see a project all the way through, it's kind of like a movie. You know, you do create something and you have an idea of it. And so they really respect that. But I don't tell them, and you can't tell them, what type of book to put out.
Right.
Whether it's softbound, hardbound, you know, what size, whatever, that's up to them, because that's, you know, they're incurring costs, and they have an idea of how they can market it, and they query places that are going to pre-order it. So, as an author, you have to go with that. And sure enough, this pops up, and the book's coming out November 12th of this year, and it says hardcover. And I was like, wow, I haven't had a hardcover book since 100 Ranger Greats 2009, so that excited the hell out of me.
As well it should. That is a tremendous feat there, and again, people
there's not that many hardcover now. I'm sure it will not be a massive hardcover book because the pictures aren't that big. But just the fact that it's in hardcover, I feel like books are making a comeback anyhow a little bit. I know the ebook thing was hot for a while, and,
right.
and it still has its purpose. But it is amazing how, since like the vinyl record comeback, that books have sort of come back.
That's right. That's right, and this is going to be a part of that movement here. Pioneers of Baseball, available in November in hardback, but you can pre-order it now. And Russ Cohen, best of luck with this project. I know it will be successful, as past books have. And again, great to be able to break this down with you here.
Always a pleasure, Rick. I mean, you're always the first guy I come to, and I really appreciate that.
Well, thanks very much, my friend. Appreciate it. Best of luck with the book, Pioneers of Baseball. And again, it's been great to be able to break it down here on FDH Lounge, mini episode number 871.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.